Peritoneal portion of the abdominal cavity. All of this area here is covered, as you've seen, by peritoneum. And looking basically at the kidneys, the inferior vena cava, the dorsal aorta, and the branches thereof, in addition to the kidneys, the ureters. So we'll be covering all of that as we go through. The position of the question. Still too low, okay. Okay, well, the trick is get it up enough so it doesn't ring. How's that? Is it working without ringing? So the position of the kidneys, I can't see this very well, but the top of the left kidney is right here, which is lower than the top of the right kidney. So the left kidney sits lower than the right. And that's because obviously there's more liver here pushing down on the kidney, it's preventing the pushing down on the diaphragm, which pushes down the kidney. And therefore the kidney on the left sits closer to the ribs. In other words, the 11th rib and 12th rib here cover at least half of the kidney on the left, but usually on the right there's only maybe one rib or up toward the top. Maybe there's three on this side and two on that side. So it's a little more exposed on the right side, but then again, a lot of the injury to kidneys comes not from something penetrating, but a blow which breaks the rib, and the rib can break inward into the peritoneal or retroperitoneal space and lacerate kidney. And we'll see a little bit why that is such a dangerous situation. Whoops, where was I? Right, this one goes forward. So, looking from the back, we see here the right kidney under the 12th rib and a little bit under the 11th, usually under the 12th, and on the left side, you've got the 11th and 12th ribs crossing the kidney. And the kidneys medial to the 12th rib are protected by two rather large muscles. We'll see that in a few moments. And the access to the kidney is obviously very easy through this posterior portion. I think probably best we'll let that one go until we look at the dorsal dorsal fascia. The kidneys lying retroperitoneally behind the peritoneum on the dorsal body wall are in contact with a number of structures. Obviously the diaphragm, the adrenals over here, we'll talk about the descending portion of the duodenum, and the right kidney over here, the tail of pancreas is rather close, and this portion of the dorsal mesentery here is called the lianal renal ligament, because it is going to the area of the spleen before it comes down here to the posterior abdominal wall, but it actually inserts in the peritoneum over the kidney. So it's like a little bare area of the kidney here where that dorsal mesentery inserts. And that's not that important. I just emphasize there's a lot of organs contacting the kidney on both sides. The kidneys are encapsulated in a thick connective tissue fascia. And this is the renal fascia, also known as Girota's fascia, first described in Italian anatomist. And Girota's fascia not only encapsulates the kidney, but it Girota's fascia comes basically from the deep fascia around the aorta and so forth, and around the vessels of the kidney. So there can be sometimes communication between the space under this fascia and the other side. Also, here's part of the collecting system here, and that fascia will just extend around that the ureter all the way down to the into the pelvis, into the bladder. The interesting thing about Girota's fascia is it separates two layers of fat. And so we see here, here's the kidney in a parasagittal section, and there is a layer of fascia out here, which that surrounds the kidney. There's a little septa going between, separating the kidney and the adrenal gland, and but the renal fascia goes up also over the adrenal gland and down on the other side. So this is all a space, and there's fat inside and fat outside. And the fat outside Jerome's fascia is basically, it's a pararenal fat. It's more distant to the kidney than the layer inside, which is perirenal fat. So the kidney basically is supported pretty much by the Jerome's fascia and the fat packed in on the inside and fat packed around it on the other outside. Pushing the wrong button. I wonder what's getting away. There we go. So this is pretty much this, and we can see here the renal fascia over here, the paranephric fat, and the perinephric fat. The perinephric fat is, we'll see, cascades into the sinus of the kidney, the renal pelvis, and it just fills up the space inside the kidney and around the vessels and provides a bed for the renal artery, renal vein. So what you don't see here is you don't see any ligaments supporting the kidneys. They're packed in fascia retroperitoneally, and basically they're as long as that fat stays there, they stay pretty much supported, pretty much. They're also tethered by the vessels. The renal artery coming off of the aorta and the renal vein going into the inferior vena cava. And as long as the fat stays there, they're usually pretty good. But what happens when people go on a diet? Not much, because this fat has, there are certain regions in the body where the fat doesn't undergo it's more stable than fat in other places in the body, so there's no great fluctuations in it. We can go on diets and not worry about losing the perirenal fat. If a person has eating disorder, anorexia, then this might become a problem, and the kidneys may start dropping. In cases of starvation, this becomes a problem, because at some point that fat stops being reabsorbed. The areas where it isn't, where it's like this, there's a region around the rectum, in the perineum, where it's like this. It tends not to be reabsorbed. The fat under and around the eyeball is the same type of fat. It doesn't tend to be reabsorbed. And in this region between the shoulder blades, like the hump region. In fact, in the elderly, sometimes they'll develop a hump back there, which is not necessarily a crooked spine, but just a large deposit of this slow metabolic fat. Now, in some normal, healthy individuals, the kidneys will also start to drop. You don't have to have something severe like anorexia or wasting disease. And usually, you look into what is their pastime, what do they like doing. And can you think of anything which would result in a dropping of the kidneys, nephrotosis? Okay, there's a bunch of things coming up over here. Horseback riding, absolutely. And you come off a horse and you might be kind of tired, a little bit achy. Oh, this area right in here. You know, it's what's happened is you're jiggling, and horseback riding, I can tell you, I don't ride horses, but I spend a lot of time on a motorcycle. And again, you get nephrotosis on that. Truck drivers, they're behind the wheel, and the suspensions in the cabs aren't all that great all the time, and they can get nephrotosis. So stay out of the cab, stay off the horse for a while, or more freeway driving than New York City driving on a motorcycle, and it will be better for that. So that's nephrotosis. We all suffer from it. Sometimes it can get severe enough so there would be a little bit of passage of blood. The urine might become a little bit blood-tinged because they can be pulling on the vessels. And nephrotosis is basically traction on the vessels. The vessels have some sensory innovation on that. When that traction increases, you know it. So here, basically, is the renal fascia, and the fat outside of that is the paranephric fat, and the fat inside of it, you see it layer over here, is the perinephric fat. So here we see the dorsal aorta. I haven't opened that yet, I'm sorry, this is peritoneum. Here's the inferior vena cava, the left renal vein, and right here we're seeing pararenal fat and the renal capsule on this side. As we go down, okay, this is a little better. Okay, now Grotthus' fascia has been cut, and now we're getting into the perinephric fat around the kidney. I can take the kidney, that kidney, and just flip it this way. And so it's been flipped off the bed, and here's the kidney, and there's the perinephric fat around it, and here's Grotthus' fascia again. Kidney should come out very cleanly from this. If there's been disease in here, there might be some adhesions, but if the kidney is relatively disease-free, it should just separate very easily in this fascial plane between the true capsule of the kidney and the perinephric fat. Kidney. This is the right kidney from behind. It's basically bean-shaped, kidney bean-shaped to be specific. I'm not supposed to use itself as to describe it, but that's what it is. There's an indentation in the, called the hilum of the kidney, and inside of that there is a area, the renal pelvis, which is filled with that perinephric fat, which just cascades in there and supports all the vessels and the branches, and so the branching over here. And here's the ureter coming out. This is the renal pelvis up here. And the renal pelvis is the almost, but not quite, the most proximal portion of the collecting system. And it drains into the ureter coming down here. So renal sinus in this region at the hilum. And in the renal sinus, we have the tributaries of the renal arteries, the renal veins, and this is the renal pelvis right here, which is the where the urea actually is beginning. Things have come together and into the urea. If you split the kidney open, we can see right here is the renal sinus, and this is usually quite fat-filled. They take a lot of the fat out, and we can see the arteries going to various portions of the segmental arteries going to various portions, and the veins drain back from various portions. And the this part right here and over here and up here, these are parts of the excretory duct, which is coming together here and here to form the renal pelvis and the ureter. So kidney, renal pelvis, renal artery coming in, renal vein leaving. And you can see some interesting characteristics of the veins here. The vena cava, inferior vena cava, tends to lie to the right, the aorta tends to lie to the left. So therefore, the right renal artery lies posterior to the inferior vena cava, whereas the left renal vein lies anterior to the inferior vena cava, and here you can see it passing under the superior mesenteric artery. So again, the artery is coming in, and now we have the renal pelvis coming out of the kidney at the renal sinus, the hilum. But you can see here how it's just kind of full of this perinephric fat, fat in the renal sinus, and we see the terminal portion, or the beginning portion, rather, of the excretory ducts, And up here, we can see these little like demilunes. And into each demilune is poking one, or sometimes more than one, renal pyramids. And these are the pyramids in here. And you notice the region of the renal pyramids is redder. And the region outside tends to be less, a little red, a little more pinker than red. So that pinker outside area is called the renal cortex, and the darker area is the renal medulla, or medulla, whichever you prefer. And also there are these columns of Purkinje, which come between the pyramids and kind of define this pyramid from this pyramid and this pyramid from that pyramid. But the important thing is this is all the excretory cells of the nephrons, and there will be the urine that they are excreting gets dumped into these little structures, which are called the minor calyces. And minor because they only pick up usually one, sometimes a pair of pyramids, and therefore, since there are about 18 lobes in the kidneys, these little areas here, lobes, there's about 18 to 2 dozen minor calyces, which come together into larger structures, which are called major calyces. And the major calyces coalesce to form the renal pelvis. And so they're coming together. Anyway, 18 to 24 minor calyces. But all on x-ray, these little minor calyces look exactly like a golf tee. You can see the little dip in it, and then it goes down from there into larger structures. So those are the, very easy to see those as minor calyces, look just like golf tees. The blood supply coming into the kidney is rather variable, and we have basically the renal artery on either side. And look at the size of the renal arteries. They're huge. What does that tell you? There's a lot of blood going through the kidney. Anyone know how much? What percentage of blood? Yeah, 20-25% of... So if each beat is putting out 75 to 80 cc's, then of that, 20 cc's is basically destined to go through the kidneys. So they're rather large structures, and therefore the kidneys are very vascular organs. And since they're very vascular, if the kidney is lacerated, such as with a broken rib, it is going to bleed. And many cases of people dying of internal bleeding is usually a lacerated kidney or a lacerated spleen. A lot of blood going through both those organs. So we see basically the renal artery coming in, and it's breaking up into a number of branches. And these branches actually define the lobes of the kidney. So anteriorly we have a superior lobe, and therefore a superior lobar artery. We have an anterior superior lobe here, so we have anterior superior artery here, an inferior superior anterior lobe, and likewise supplied by an inferior anterior artery, and an inferior, a lower polar artery coming down through this region here. So superior up here, anterior superior, anterior inferior, and then down here the inferior. So that accounts for 1, 2, 3, 4 segmental arteries. And on the back side of the heart, there is one posterior, which you see right in there, going to the posterior portion of the kidney. As a result of the percolation of blood coming through from anterior branches and a single posterior branch, and a few polar branches more toward the end, if you need access to the kidney, you don't want to cut anteriorly, there's too much to cut. You don't want to cut posteriorly, there's too much to cut. So if there was staghorn calculi in here, which you just had to go in surgically to remove, where do you cut? bloodless line. Where's the bloodless line? Right over here between anterior and posterior. And you open the kidney like a book. And there's almost no collateral circulation from one side to the other. And one can get in there and do that. It's very interesting. That's known as Brodel's white line. It appears a little bit pale in the live, healthy kidney. And no, Dr. Brodel was not a physician. What is he doing describing a structure like this if he's not an anatomist, not a physician? He was a medical illustrator. And he noticed that when he was dissecting kidneys on a commission, and brought the attention of the surgeon, and, oh, that's interesting. Brodel was right. So they still use that today. Of course, a lot of the kidney stones which can form in these branching collecting system here can develop calculi. Stones can develop in there. And horrible things can develop in here. Things called staghorn calculi. And they just like that. They can extend from this minor calyx to that minor calyx and over here as well. And if those things break loose, they just start tearing their way down. And they're not going to pass it through the ureter, so they hang up, cause irritation, and they either have to bring an instrument up through the ureter and crush those, or they can do it now with ultrasonic means, putting a person in a vat of water and giving them some anesthesia so they can relax and not trip out with the noise which this thing involves. And but those sound vibrations can basically shake those calculi apart, and then the person will, you know, be able to pass those chunks of calculi. So you can see here that an angiogram of the kidney can be rather important. So looking at that, you can see here's the common hepatic artery here, the celiac trunk you can't see looking dead on. Here's the splenic artery going over that way. And just below them we have the right renal artery and the left renal artery. And which artery is longer? The right renal artery is longer, so because it has to extend across the inferior vena cava, but the left one is much shorter because the aorta is closer to the kidney on the left side. So basically, a few things can be done. A injection can be made of containing some contrast material, and that will go through the circulatory system and be excreted by the kidneys and show up in the bladder. But while it's being excreted by the kidneys, you can see something going through. Also, what you can do it is up through the groin, insert a catheter in the artery, retrograde through the iliac vessels and up through the distal abdominal aorta and right into the renal artery, take your pick, left or right. If you do that, then you get a nice x-ray such as this of the renal circulatory system. But the IVP is a little more helpful in many respects because if there's any area of the kidney which isn't being perfused, you can pick that up. Now here is like in the first instance where a person was given an injection of contrast material that went through the body and got selectively excreted by the kidney. Whoops, you can see, let me go back and do it sequentially. At 1 second, this is done by catheter, okay? So here's the contrast coming to the kidney, and the arterial system is lighting up. And not only is the arterial system lighting up, part of the tissue is lighting up in here as the contrast material gets into the capillary networks, which the arteries are feeding. Then a brief 7 seconds later, you take another picture, and the parts of the parenchyma are lighting up. You don't see any arteries, but you do still see a catheter coming up into the right renal artery here. But what is lighting up? Something here, something here, something here, 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 down through here. Well, these are the minor calyces over here and up here, and they're leading into the major calyces and the renal pelvis in this region. So now this is coming down now through the ureter. What's happening here? See a nice ureter here. I lose it in this region. There it is again. There it is again. That's lost down here. What's going on? Is there a tumor pressing on there? Is it normal? Is it abnormal? Is that that way? How many think it's normal? Okay, you're right. It's normal. So what could it be if it's normal? What does things like that? Peristalsis. Absolutely. Because the ureter undergoes peristalsis. And this is a picture here of a person urinating. I can guarantee you right now, you are all urinating in your seats right now. Hopefully nobody is micturating. Okay? Micturation is what you're going to do outside the door over there, but urination technically is the passage of urine by peristaltic waves down the ureter, which is okay. So we just saw this. This is going to the kidney. This is the catheter introduced into the femoral artery, just distal to the inguinal ligament. Catheter passes up, and this is done under fluoroscopy, and they can poke the tip of the catheter into the renal artery. But sometimes they have trouble finding a renal artery because look what we have over here. Three renal arteries. And basically, there can be even more than that. And even though there's only there's three arteries, a little bit smaller, when these arteries are disturbed, they can bleed more than you want to know about. And also, if you get in, you know how easy it is to get the kidney out of its bed of perinephric fat. If you go in and just shell the kidney out, and you're not aware of something like this, it'll break. But it doesn't break here or here. We can put a clamp on it and make nice. It pulls right off the aorta. So now you've got this stream going out onto someone's glasses or all over the OR or whatever. And now you've got to get control of that, and you feel like a little boy in Holland putting his finger in the dike, you know. So this is why, basically, if they're going to be doing any surgery on the kidney, they'll usually do an angiogram first, just so they're not surprised by these abnormalities. Okay, so I've mentioned the cortex out here in the DACA medullary region of the kidney. And if we go through and look at what's causing that, we notice that in the DACA medulla, there's a lot of regularity of the tissue. In fact, these are the nephrons here, all lined up, and the blood vessels are coming down between the nephrons. And since the blood vessels are associated with every nephron, has blood vessels around it, this is a very, very vascular region. Out here, it's a little more scattered, but there is still a regularity to it. So if you see here at this particular pyramid, the blood vessels coming in, we have interlobular branches going up between the lobes and arcuate across the top of the medulla, and then we have these little branches going up, and those little pink things on the end are the glomeruli. And so therefore we have basically The medullary region is all lined up with a lot of straight portions of the nephron, and out here is the more convoluted portions of the nephron. So I've used a couple terms here to already define these. So we see here the little arteries coming up between the lobes, giving off the glomerular branches here, which basically are surrounded by the end of the nephron. The nephron kind of engulfs it, encapsulates it. It leaves a nice little hollow area right around in there. And this is where the business of providing the provisional urine occurs. What is the function of the kidney? Many, but what's the principal function to think of? No one knows what the kidney does? It makes urine, right? No, that's like saying the function of a steel mill is to produce slag. Okay, the purpose of the kidney is conservation. Right now, today, between now and this time tomorrow, you will have excreted anywhere from 100 to 200 millimeters of provisional urine. If you didn't recover from that, you'd have to carry a little cart around with us to fill up over the day. 200 liters? That's a lot of urine. But we know that when we go to the bathroom, it's only about 500 cc's, 400 cc's, 300 cc's. And if we go to the bathroom three or four times a day or six times a day, ultimately we're only excreting anywhere from 1 to 2 liters over a period of a day. So we reduce it by a factor of 100. That's impressive. So what happens, I'm going to go very quickly through this, you get this, and here's a nephron. Here's the tubule here, and it comes up and expands and surrounds this capillary network, just kind of bulges into this tube. This is called the glomerulus. Actually, the blood tuft here is called the glomerulus. It's Bowman's capsule, or the capsule of the nephron. And there's all these little things on the surface of the blood vessels. And this confused the microscopists for a while, until they finally figured it out that these are little cells with very elaborate octopus-like feet. And if you look at that electron microscope, and this is what they kind of did, they've got three-dimensional viewpoint from this. Here's a capillary. These are the pores in the capillary. And you can see that capillary is not going to hold water, and it doesn't. So the capillaries really let the water flow out. But there's these little podocytes, these little interdigitating parts from adjacent arms of these cells. And if they expand or shrink, they will cover more holes here or less holes or even come together and form kind of a seal around this. Amazing, amazing mechanism for controlling the flow of provisional urine. And so the provisional urine dumps out into this first part of the tubule. It's convoluted up here, so it's the proximal convoluted tubule. And there's a capillary network around that. And the kidney gets very, very busy, extremely busy, reabsorbing. Reabsorbing everything that went out. And these are some examples here of proximal convoluted tubules. And those of you can see that in the tubules, there's a lot of cellular mechanics in there and tremendous amounts of mitochondria. Very, very busy cell, pumping like hell to get this water and electrolytes back into the blood system. And these vessels, which come away from the kidney, have a very hypertonic plasma level in them because a lot of the water leaked out. So now it's easy enough for that water to be work its way back into this hypertonic blood. And then from this convoluted tubule, it goes down to a straight segment. And let's see, over here, here's part of the convoluted, part of the straight segment here is coming down in the medulla of the kidney. And look how busy these cells are, but look at the amount of brush border that they have here. That's all cellular surface, which is sucking up the water. And at this end of the cell, a lot of mitochondria, and they're actively pumping ions and stuff out, and water is going to follow osmotically. But then at the very base of the at the pyramid, the tube turns around. It's coming down this way, but going back this way, and it gets very thin. Look how close the blood vessels are here. And again, the passive flow of water from the thin tubule across this thin membrane into the hyperosmotic blood. So again, conservation. And then as we go back up the tube, we get into distal tubules, and here's distal. And notice the distal is almost no brush border. It's proximal, a lot of absorptive surface, not so much here. And some of the fine-tuning occurs in the distal tubule. There's areas with this sensitive to aldosterone, which will promote uptake of ions or inhibit or whatever. And it will, as the blood gets thinner, the kidneys will compensate that by secreting hormones and cause more absorption. So it's a very nice, in physiology, it's a phenomenal mechanism. Anyway, I'd be remiss for not mentioning it here, just the putting the whole thing together, and it's rather awesome in the correct use of that word. This is a collecting system. In the collecting system, the cells are smooth, but bumpy. But if you put urine in here and start filling up with urine, sometimes you notice that you get up in the morning and you urinate, and then within an hour you urinate again. Just went, but all that urine for the second urination was up in these tubules and expanded, and these cells became kind of extended and flattened, and so basically more was just waiting to be peristalsed down the ureters, and eventually, here we go again. So the ureters, we saw how they were formed by the calyces, and the minor calyces leading to the major calyces leading to the renal pelvis, and the ureters come down in the abdomen, and they arch over the external iliac vessels and dive down to the deep pelvis to come to the bladder. Now, there's important areas in here. The first area is right at with the renal pelvis, which is pretty wide, narrows down to the size of the ureter. And right there, since that narrowing occurs, a kidney stone can lodge there. So that's not good. So that's the first place of narrowing. And that's important. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. Then down here, as it comes over the great vessels, it kind of gets stretched. That little stretching over the vessels there attenuates the ureter, and the second place of narrowing. So if a stone gets by this area, it might hang up as the ureter goes down into the deep pelvis. Then as it goes in through the wall of the bladder, there's usually a little muscular tension in that wall, there's a third area of narrowing. And that's important to know. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. It's this one. So we mentioned, actually, let's just move on from those. Covered it. Did that. Okay, let's see what comes up. Okay, there can be variation in the ureters. Look at this ureter, instead of coming down parallel to the inferior vena cava, it's looking behind it and around it and coming down back down this way. This could be a point of constriction. In fact, the artist here is showing the ureter wider up here than here. So that's going to cause basically hydronephrosis, which is basically backing up urine into the kidney. The kidney stops producing urine, and the blood diffusing through that kidney starts putting out signals that we need more pressure to get more blood through here, but that's not answering the problem. So that's one of the bases of hypertension, is a screw up there of the pressure. You're getting false messages for the pressure balancing. Over here we can see an abnormality. We have a third kidney. These two kidney analog and never came together. So here's like a one ureter going to another with another parasitic kidney there, and then coming down into the pelvis. So a lot of variation can occur in the ureas. Here's a dual urea. Here's a false. It doesn't go anywhere because it comes ex hoc up here. Usually, when they find these, they will cut them in up here because oftentimes there's not enough urine flow in each of these ureters to prevent bacteria from coming up this way. So dual ureters tend to predispose to pyelonephritis, which is a infection of the kidney. The arterial supply to the kidneys is very variable. Keep in mind that if we have polar arteries and hilar arteries, here's a polar artery here, which comes off the inferior gingival cava. There might be another, here's another one up in the top here, coming off the dorsal aorta, down here, coming off the dorsal aorta. So these are polar arteries that are coming off the dorsal aorta. Let me see if we have this artery here. Looks like it, but it's actually called a hilar artery. I would not make any distinctions between polar arteries or hilar arteries. They're both abnormal. They're coming off not in the renal sinus, but way out here, away from the renal sinus, or indeed off of the descending aorta itself. Over here is an example of an inferior polar artery, and it's compressing the ureter, and here's hydronephrosis again. And that kidney is not going to work. It's still being perfused by blood, but nothing's happening. It's excessively hypoosmotic. The messages are going to go out from the kidney by way of hormones that say increased heart beat and get more blood to the kidneys. But it's not going to help because we've got this blockage down here, and that has to be addressed surgically. Keep in mind that what would you tend to do there? Cut the vessel or cut the ureter? We can't ligate the vessel permanently because these are end arteries. So you're going to have necrosis of the lower pole of the kidney. It might be easier to ligate the ureter, bring it on both sides of the vessel without injuring the vessel, and re-anastomosing the ureter, and everything will be fine. A peristaltic wave, no problems. The peristaltic wave starts up here. As it gets down to the region of anastomosis, the peristaltic wave will start another one as urine is pushed past the line of the suture, where the sutures were, the healing line, and that part of the ureter expands, and boom, you get another peristaltic wave starting de novo from that point down. So here again, some variations. I'm just showing you a lot of variations because they happen. Don't be surprised when you see them happening like this. You may find some people have a kidney down here, a horseshoe kidney, which is a variation. This is a variation where the kidney is just kind of, it didn't fall, this is not nephritosis, the kidney developed down here. And actually that's a basis for a renal transplant. If you go in and watch renal surgery, if you're not aware of this, you could be actually shocked when the surgeon starts implanting the kidney down in the pelvis. And even you know the kidneys belong up here. But you know what? It's a lot easier to implant it into the pelvis, and you can use a short stump of ureter to bring it right into the bladder. There's a good blood supply right there, which you can tie the implanted renal artery to, and the vein right there, which you can tie in the venous return. A wonderful place to get a nice renal transplant, and the body tolerates that very, very well. Here's a low beta kidney. Remember that the fetal, basically it exhibits the fetal pattern. And each of these lobations has its own separate artery, and guess what? They're all end arteries. Here's a horseshoe kidney. They fuse across the midline. I don't know what they call this. It's like a pancake kidney. Here's an up-down organism. Yeah, just be aware. We'll see some of these things in the lab. Now, the blood supply to the kidney, we've talked about, but we haven't talked about the blood supply to the urethra. And we'll talk about this, I'll pick it up again in a few minutes, and then again, we'll talk about the pelvic urethra. The blood supply to the urethra is very, very opportunistic. The blood supply will come from branches from the renal artery. It can come from little branches from the spermatic artery or ovarian artery over here. It can come from little branches right from the aorta itself. And guess what? They're all end arteries. You don't want to mess with those. If you're in there doing something and it looks like you're going to have to move the urethra, and you want to pull them off, call in a urologist and let them take over the surgery in this area. Frequently, the surgeons, when they're near this area, will just take surgical tape and just lay that tape right on top of it so it's a visual reminder. Stay away from here. There's baby dragons. You know. Okay, let me go back on this slide. And what I want to talk about now is the adrenal gland, which sits on top of the kidney, still within the Jarolli's fascia, but there's also a leaf of the fascia between the adrenal and the kidney. The left adrenal gland is a little lower usually than the right, and you can see here the blood supply. The first two branches of the abdominal aorta, as soon as the aorta comes through, the aortic hiatus of the diaphragm, which is right here, it gives off left and right inferior phrenic arteries. And from the inferior phrenic arteries, look at this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 branches coming into the adrenal gland. And that's a superior supply. Then there's a middle supply here from the middle suprarenal artery coming right off the aorta. And then there can be branches from the left renal artery, right renal artery coming up into the adrenal gland. So it has a tremendous blood supply and a varied blood supply. And yes, the blood supply is anastomotic from any one of these. So if one of these has to be sacrificed, the adrenal seems to be pretty well without that. On the other side, the same thing. Here's your superior renal arteries, about a dozen of them coming off the inferior phrenic artery. Here's the middle suprarenal artery and the inferior renal artery coming off the, in this case, this is the left renal artery. So a lot of blood supply, you can see that. Your superior branches off the inferior phrenic artery, middle here, doesn't inferior adrenal over here coming off the renal. A lot there. A lot of dragons to worry about there too with surgery. On the venous return, very simple. Here's your suprarenal vein right there coming from the adrenal gland going right into the inferior vena cava. And on the left side, the suprarenal vein over here coming into the renal vein. And usually on this side, the inferior phrenic vein comes down and joins that. Where on the right side, it goes in, the vein goes in separately. So here we see the suprarenal vein on the left side going directly, would be going directly into the inferior vena cava. Now because of this, the lay of the land here, look, if you can visualize the inferior vena cava lying right in here, this vessel is pretty much coming in almost, you know, posterolaterally to the inferior vena cava. So the adrenal gland, there's a little groove in it right here. That's where the inferior vena cava lies. So it's very intimate in its contact. And you can't tug on the suprarenal very much before you snap that vein. And what happens when you snap the vein? It doesn't break at the adrenal. It pulls out of what? Inferior vena cava. So again, it could be venous blood spurs in that. So that has to be taken care of. Now, when they're operating on adrenals, it's usually for a reason. There's a pheochromocytoma, for instance, and a person will have a malignancy of the chromatin cells and producing much more adrenaline from the adrenals, and that gets into the, picked up by the veins, goes out to the blood supply, and can be quite a problem. If these can get rather large, like a large pheochromocytoma, this is something that no attending will let a medical student near, because if a student comes up and tries to palpate and disturbs that, suddenly the patient is, blood pressure is shooting off the manometer, they're flushed, they're breathing more rapidly, you've given them quite a shock just by palpating and releasing that. So that could be treated very, very carefully. So when a surgeon gets in there, what's the first thing they're going to do? What's the first step they do to do the adrenalectomy? It should make sense from what I've said. Okay, now keep in mind, once you start cutting the adrenals and moving the arteries around, you're doing what to the adrenal? Jiggling, moving, and so forth. And where is that adrenaline going? Out the vein. So what's the first thing the surgeon's going to do? Smart. Ligate the vein. Then you can screw around with the gland all you want, and nothing's going anywhere. So that's the first thing. Identify the vein, ligate the vein very, very carefully, and then after that you can go in and ligate all these little arteries from the superiors, the middles, and the inferiors, and hope you got them all, and then shell out the adrenal. So it's very important to be very careful with that, and I think you'll understand now if a attending or a resident says, we don't want you palpating this patient. Yeah. Give you a feel in there. Okay, there can be accessory adrenal glands. You know, bip, here they are normally, but they can be in different locations, anywhere in basically the posterior portion of the cavity. So those are just more common locations. Why do you have to be aware of it? Because maybe the adrenaline isn't coming from the adrenal, maybe it's coming from a pheochromocytoma in some of this outlying tissue. So it's very important to kind of keep that in mind. Okay, this is getting close here. What we're going to do is going to give a break and we'll come back and do the abdominal wall pretty quickly. But let's just work through this. And this is the innovation to the kidneys and the proximal portion of the ureter. So what we want to be looking for, basically, oh, by the way, I did make a mistake in lecture yesterday where I didn't. When I was showing the illustration, I think it was over there, of a small bowel, and there was a large bowel with a T12 region. Yeah, there should be a T12 region. That wasn't the mistake I was trying to point out. It was something else in there that was really wrong. So, anyway, here we have I'll go over that in a minute again. We'll pick that up. Keep the thought. Here we have T12. So coming out the white ramus minicans of T12 and going to the diaphragm, we have which splanchnic nerve? This is the greater up here, this is the lesser, this is the least, okay? And the least splanchnic nerve is associated with what's this ganglion down here? Aortic renal ganglion, right. So each level, each named splanchnic nerve should have an association there. So the least splanchnic nerve primarily goes to the aortic renal ganglion, which is going to be supplying the kidney and controlling, to some extent, the blood flow through the kidney, although most of that is done just by affecting the heart. But it does have sympathetics going out there. And also these are going down to the ureter, proximal ureter here, to help control peristalsis. But the big thing here is that the renal sinus, the major and minor calyces, renal pelvis, ureta, proximal ureta, all have sensory afferents come from these structures. And the sensory afferents are going to go back along the aortic renal, aortic renal ganglion, and through the least splanchnic nerve to the T12 area. What's the T12 dermatome? Subcostal, right? So, therefore, if there's any renal stones associated with the kidney or the upper portion of the ureta, the pain is going to be referred under the last rib, under the ribs. It's the subcostal dermatome, and it comes along the 12th rib over here, and where does it end up? Down kind of in the pubic region. Okay, so that dermatome on one side should be screaming if there is something going on, pathology going on in the minor calyces, greater calyces, and the renal pelvis, and also the proximal ureta. So that's the pathway there. But also going back in that pathway through this this plexus kind of is sometimes usually associated with the superior mesenteric plexus and even the celiac plexus to some extent. So some of the afferents which are coming through here are also coming from the colon in the vicinity, rather small area of the colon in the vicinity of the splenic flexure is also T12. Then L1 and L2 are going to be doing the rest of the colon through the lesser mesenteric plexus. Okay, so much of that for now. So you see basically the afferents from the collecting system and proximal ureta going back up to the least splanchnic nerve, retrograde along the white ramus communicans and into the spinal cord at the T12 levels, this pathway here, up to the T12 level of spinal cord, and the base of referred pain. And remember, kidneys are, there's one on each side, so unlike the appendix, I see that one, right. Why do I feel pain in this kidney and this kidney? Referred pain goes in that particular dermatome on one side or the other. But my appendix, which is over here on the right, why doesn't that refer to the right side only? Yeah, you got it. The gut starts out like this, a midline organ. And no matter where it ends up in the abdomen, still has the innervation on midline organ. And the kidneys have a split innervation left and right. Something you don't think of sometimes, you know, or B. Why is it over here? Why is it midline? What's over there? The entire bowel and gut, stomach, so forth, are all midline organs. And therefore, we tend to refer pain both sides, but you kind of localize it more towards the middle. Okay. Final point, I think, before we go into the app, and I'll take a break, as I said. The adrenal gland. And here we see the adrenal, and it's getting a... Look at all these presynaptic neurons going in there. Some are coming from the least splanchnic nerve, some come from the lesser splanchnic nerve, and maybe some are even coming from the greater splanchnic nerve, all to the adrenal gland. Where are the postsynaptic neurons coming from the adrenal gland? The postsynaptic neurons here are shown, I think, as dotted lines. Okay. Where are the dotted lines coming from the adrenal? Yeah, you can see. There aren't any, right? So there's no postsynaptic neuron coming out of the adrenal. Here, presynaptic is going in. But you know they have to synapse on postsynaptics. And when we talked about the pheochromocytomas were tumors of the adrenaline-producing cells, and those adrenaline-producing cells are basically adrenergic cells. Now you see the correlation? What other adrenergic cells do you know of? Which neurons secrete? I'm right, adrenaline and norepinephrine. Right, the second order sympathetic chain neuron. Second order neuron of the sympathetic pathway. And these cells, the theophrome cells in the adrenal, produce that substance, the adrenaline. So that is the equivalent. Indeed, the second order sympathetic neurons come embryologically, developmentally, from the same place that the cells of the adrenal medulla come from, the neural crest tissue. You've got that in development, right? Okay, so now it makes sense. So that has very important implications on that. Wake up, damn it! What's happening right now? Take your pulse. It's a little. You feel very, very alert. Okay. Nothing to do with the adrenal, because you know what's happening. It's already happened from the sympathetic is going to the heart, cause you to put out more blood per stroke. Your heart's beating faster. Adrenaline has gone out to all the lungs.